This is a speaker meeting, and the committee has asked John H. to share his experience, strength, and hope.
John, I'm an addict.
John.
Oh, boy, I'm nervous. Give me a few minutes to get grounded. Yeah, they told you they asked me to share my experience, strength, and hope. They didn't tell you that they just asked me 5 minutes ago. So I came down. I volunteered to work the concession stand, and you know, sometimes that's what happens if we stay clean. We keep coming around, and next thing you know, you get asked to stand up and share your experience, strength, and hope. I want to start by wishing everybody a Merry Christmas. You know, this day brings up some real good feelings. It also brings up some real bad feelings. The good feelings come from the Christmases I've experienced clean, and the bad feelings come from the experiences, the Christmases I experienced using. And I'm grateful today that I got to experience another clean Christmas. I guess a good place to start is with what I know. And what I know is if I leave this meeting tonight and I use, I won't stop. That's I've learned that through experience. For me to get to Narcotics Anonymous, it required handcuffs. It required a cell. It required me using to the point that, you know, hopeless desperation. You know, I harmed a lot of people while I was using. People I harmed the most were the people who loved me, the people who cared about me. And I'm not real proud of that, but that's what it took for me to know that, you know, when I use, I don't stop. I'm one of the luckiest addicts who ever lived because I ended up getting invited to this place called Narcotics Anonymous. And today I know that I don't have to use. You know, the lie is dead. We do recover. And you know, I told you 5 minutes before the meeting, they asked me if I'd share my experience, strength, and hope. And I got real nervous. And what I do when that happens is, you know, I walked over into a desolate part of the parking lot, looked up at the sky, I saw the moon, I saw the stars. I said a prayer. I asked my higher power to, you know, to take my will in my life, guide me in my recovery, and show me how to live. And that's what I've learned how to do here. I don't like to talk a whole lot about what it was like, but somebody did that for me at my first meeting, and it changed my life. You know, I'm one of those addicts that started using when I was a kid. I was about 10 years old, and my first experience was with alcohol. I split a pint of whiskey with a kid before school one day, and I blacked out. I got drunk. I'd love to tell you what I did, but all I really know are stories about what they said I did. I got in a lot of trouble, and the important thing about this story is I swore I'd never do that again. I know today that I don't have the power to just, you know, I did that over and over and over again. You know, shortly after that, I experimented with marijuana, and I was off to the races. I'd like to share at this point, I don't have a drug of choice. I never could pick just one. If there's anything I didn't try, it's just because it wasn't on the table in front of me. I love Narcotics Anonymous because we don't distinguish between drugs here. You know, it's all the same to me. I suffer from the disease of addiction. With your help, I can stay clean. You know, my story's kind of, you know, I didn't grow up in Phoenix. I'm from a small town in Colorado. And what we did back there was we used. You know, that's what everybody did. And by the time I was 17 years old, I'd pretty much burned every bridge there was to burn back there. You know, I don't come from the wrong part of town. You know, my dad's a doctor. My mom was a teacher. You know, I come from a good family. And I also come from a long line of addicts. I moved to Phoenix in 1984. I was 17. And my greatest fear when I moved here was that I wouldn't be able to score. You know, and being that I was 17, I couldn't sign an apartment lease, so I was looking for apartments all over town, and the only place I could find an apartment was in Sunny Slope. And I remember sitting down with this lady who was the landlord of this dive apartment complex, and I told her my problem, because I was from a small town. I was kind of naive. And I told her that I hadn't been able to find an apartment because I was only 17. And she said, well, just change your birth date by a year. And that's what I did. You know, that fear of not being able to score in Phoenix was, it 5 minutes into being in this apartment, I found out anything and everything you wanted was within a couple doors. And, you know, my disease flourished here. I also think it's important that I share that I learned how to be an addict. You know, I was selling dope at school when I was in junior high. You know, I would take pills from my dad's cabinet, empty the stuff out, fill them with flour, and sell them for $1 apiece. And, you know, I learned all kinds of tricks along the way. And as my disease progressed, so did the finding ways and means to get more progressed. You know, early in my addiction, I was capable of holding a job. You know, when I was 17, my only goal in life was to get up, go to work, get loaded every day, and be left alone. And that worked for a little while. But as the disease progressed, and the finding ways and means to get more progressed, you know, my life got more and more unmanageable. You know, I ended up moving from Sunny Slope to Paradise Valley, from Paradise Valley over to 55th Avenue and McDowell, and along the way, I ended up meeting this woman who was a bartender, and I got to be real careful because she's here tonight. But when I met this woman, you know, we got along pretty good, and, you know, I had a few girlfriends at the time, and she was the only one who said I wasn't allowed to have more than one girlfriend, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense today, but that interested me. And, you know, what I liked best about my wife in the old days was I could trust her with my dope. You know, she wouldn't steal my dope, And you know, we built a relationship on that. We were a couple of using addicts. You know, she had a daughter, and we decided to move in together and live together and be a happy family. The only problem is that we were two using addicts, and you know, things got ugly real quick. You know, for me, I don't like to share a whole lot about what it was like, but I do like to share the story of where I was right before I got here. And what happened in March 25th, 1992, my wife and I went down to the Blockbuster Video to get some videos. I will point out that I was going to buy those videos because they wouldn't rent to me. I always had money in my pocket, but if you gave me something, I wasn't going to give it back to you. You know, it's just the way I used to live. And on the way to that Blockbuster Video, I saw a police car parked in this parking lot. And I was living off of 47th Avenue and Indian School. And I knew what was going on in the neighborhood I lived in. I knew everybody in the neighborhood. Everybody knew me. Everybody knew what I did. And I knew that police car was out of place. And So we went to the video store, and when we got to the video store, I had her drive back because I knew I had warrants out for my arrest from Mesa to Peoria, you know, and everywhere in between. And sure enough, on the way back to the house, about two blocks from the house, that police car pulled us over. The unmarked car swooped in, and they proceeded to serve an arrest warrant for me. I remember the undercover cop came around to the window, and he told me, he goes, I got a warrant for John's arrest. And I said, well, I'm not John, I'm Mike. And he said, that's okay, we got a warrant for him too. And I knew I was in trouble, you know. The game was over. They had a search warrant for my house. I'd been under surveillance for a month. The search warrant listed drugs, guns, money, jewelry, stolen property, all the things that are common with a drug enterprise. And what they found in my house was my two kids alone and a big box of dope on the kitchen table. And that's just how I used to live. You know, there was usually a shotgun on the coffee table. Towards the end, I didn't leave the house without a .45. When I become insane. You know, I was totally insane. I hadn't had a rational thought in years. And I remember pulling up to the house in the back of that police car. I was cuffed to the door handle because I had a cast on my left hand because I'd been cut the night before by one of my good friends. And I remember my oldest daughter standing at the front door while the cars were pulling up, and there were neighbors in the yard. I'll never forget the look on her face. You know, it was just another day in her screwed up little life. You know, I don't ever want to forget the look on her face. They searched the house. They found, they didn't find any guns. They didn't find any money. That's how I use, you know. There's either a lot of money or a lot of dope, not both at the same time ever. And I remember this police officer was questioning me, and he was, this is not my first time to the dance, you know. I've been arrested before. I know when they tell you got the right to remain silent, I knew I'd better take it. But, and they kept coming around trying to question me, and you know, I had armor as thick as steel back then. You know, nothing penetrated me. I felt nothing. I hadn't felt anything for anyone in a long time. But this police officer asked me a funny question. He said, that's a real nice family you got in there. He said, you ever think of getting out of the drug business and raising those kids? And I didn't flinch, but what he did say did sink in. And once again, I swore that I'd never use again. And I meant it. I ended up down at the county jail. No bond. Kind of figured I was, you know, this time I knew that I was in a lot of trouble and I was going to do some time. And a funny thing happened. 3 days into my stay at the county jail, I got loaded in an attempt to change the way I felt. You know, the first feelings I experienced in a long time were shame and guilt. And the last time I used, the only thing that happened was I felt worse. And that was March 28th of 1992. I spent a little bit of time in jail. I had a really good attorney, and the attorney made this plea to the judge that I had a drug problem and all this other stuff, and she talked this judge into letting me go letting me out of jail to go to rehab. And I remember she came into this cell to tell me that, and she was excited. You know, she worked really hard to get this judge to, this judge didn't like me too much. He didn't care for what situations I'd left those kids in. but he decided to let me go to this rehab. And I remember telling this this attorney, I'm not going to go to inpatient treatment. You know, I'll go to outpatient. And she said, the judge isn't negotiating with you. You know, this is a gift. And I told her, I got to go back to my cell and think about it. You know, I'll let you know tomorrow. And I went back to the cell. I talked to the guys I was, you know, my good friends and stuff that I was in jail with. And they pointed out to me that rehab is better than jail. And they said there's all the food you can eat. You can smoke cigarettes. There's women there. And they also pointed out to me there's no walls. You know, you can escape whenever you want. And to be perfectly honest with you, I had no intentions of staying very long at rehab. But I ended up there. I remember when I got to rehab, they did this intake thing, and this counselor asked me what I thought my greatest asset was, and I told him honesty. I'm pretty sure they're still laughing about that. But I really believed it, you know. I didn't fit in at rehab, you know. I pulled up to this place straight from jail, and people were laughing, smiling, hugging, joking, having a good time, and I knew nobody was going to hug me. You know, I mean, I just came from the county jail. I thought I'd made a big mistake. And like I said, I wasn't very popular there. People knew what I was in for. And I wasn't a very nice person back there anyway. I kept everybody at a distance. And if you tried to get close to me, I'd make sure you'd go somewhere else. But I had this counselor who she really didn't. I hated her. You know, she called me on every bit of my shit. You know, she didn't buy none of it. And after I'd been there for about a week, they give you privileges, and you can walk up to the local store, you can leave and come back. And once I found out that we'd been drinking decaf coffee for a week, I figured, well, you know, I can't have any of that. So I went up to the local Safeway and bought some Taster's Choice. And I came back because, you know, I was going to get juiced on coffee. I'm an addict, you know. And so the next thing you know, somebody realizes that I've got Taster's Choice, and they'd like some too. So before you know it, I'm selling spoons of coffee for a buck a pop. Made perfect sense to me. That's just how I lived, you know. So I get called into this counselor's office, and she told me that there were some people that actually wanted me kicked out for that. To tell you the truth, I didn't really care if they kicked me out or not. But this lady went to bat for me. She goes, John, I'm not going to let them kick you out for this. She goes, you might want to look at the pattern here. She says, you were in jail for possession for sale. She goes, they let you out to rehab, and you get in trouble for selling, you know, coffee. And I looked at the pattern, and like any good addict, I cut everybody off, you know. I still had my coffee, but they weren't going to get nothing. And to tell you the truth, that was growth for me. You know, the thought of giving somebody free coffee, we just weren't there yet, you know. And so I kept trudging along at this rehab, and it didn't make no sense to me. It was a bunch of crap, you know. I wasn't real into it. And then a funny thing happened one night. There were a couple guys that asked me if I wanted to go to an outside meeting. And this particular rehab took us to meetings, but I wasn't really into the meetings they were taking us to, you know. And so this one particular night, these guys asked me if I wanted to go to this meeting, and they told me it was different than the meetings that we'd been going to. They said it was for addicts, and that kind of got my attention, because I knew I was an addict long before I got to Narcotics Anonymous. You know, I knew I had a problem long before I got here. I'd given up all hope of ever being able to stop or even control my use. You know, towards the end of my using, my only goal in life was never to run out, and I was pretty successful at that for a long time. So I end up at this meeting in the basement of Charter Hospital, and to be perfectly honest with you, when I got in the car with those guys, I wasn't quite sure I was going to go to the meeting. You know, I was kind of getting tired of the rehab, and I was ready to just take one final last run out on the streets, and, you know, I knew if I got a little bit away from the place, made a phone call, somebody would come pick me up, and so we show up at this Charter Hospital, and I remember there was a telephone over here and the meeting over there, and what got me into my first meeting was the fact that they told me there was coffee inside. And, yeah, me and coffee, I got a pattern there. I end up into this meeting, and there's maybe seven people there. It wasn't a very big meeting. This long-haired biker guy was chairing the thing. And I sat down. Someone read the reading, Who is an Addict? And my life changed. Up until that point, I really thought I was the only one. You know, from the time I started using till that day, I never knew what was wrong with me. I never knew why I used more than everybody else. I never knew why I would go to that next level to get more. I never knew why I lied to other addicts about how much I used because it was embarrassing. You know, I never knew what was wrong with me. And I heard the reading, Who is an Addict? And something clicked. My life changed. They followed that up with what is the Narcotics Anonymous program, and that reading answered some of the questions that I had. Where I come from, nothing's free. If it sounds too good to be true, it is. And the only exception I've found to that in life is Narcotics Anonymous. This thing is true. I left that meeting with a little bit of hope. I didn't think I could stay clean forever, but I thought maybe I could just stay clean long enough to, you know, maybe do right by my wife and kids, maybe take care of some of my legal problems, maybe stay out of prison. It was a little bit of hope. I sure didn't think I could stay clean forever. I went back to that rehab. I shared with that counselor this beautiful thing known as Narcotics Anonymous, and she wasn't all that excited. What she told me she knew about Narcotics Anonymous was a revolving door, and she said I needed to go to this other fellowship. Her heart was in the right place. She was just misinformed. I call her every year on my birthday, let her know that that I got another year clean, how much I appreciate what she did for me, and that I'm still an active member of Narcotics Anonymous, and it does work. And I have a responsibility to do that. And I can hear the joy in her voice when I call her, because I've been around long enough to know that we see some real ugly stuff around here. You know, we see people get loaded and die. And I think it's important that I share with that lady once a year that I'm still clean and my family's doing good. I got out of that rehab, and they wanted me to do a whole bunch of stuff, you know, like 90 and 90, and they wanted me to go to a halfway house, and I mean, just because I went to an NA meeting and I had a little hope doesn't mean I changed overnight, you know. I mean, somebody tells me to do 90 and 90, and my, you know, I ain't doing that, and I'm not going to a halfway house, and this and that and the other thing, and I still had that real good judge in my life, you know. He gave me a choice. He says, you can go to a halfway house or you can go back to jail. And he told me if I ended up back in jail, I was going to prison, and he was going to make sure of it. So I ended up at this halfway house. Wasn't going to do 90 and 90, but the halfway house I lived at took you to a meeting every day. I didn't always get to pick the meetings I went to. You know, it was a requirement, and I didn't live there any longer than I had to, but I was required to live there until until I, you know, taken care of that legal stuff. I forgot to tell you, when my house got raided and I got busted, my mom came down from Colorado and picked my kids up. She took them back to Colorado, you know, because it's just what moms do. You know, my wife and I went to rehab together. We were the first couple that they let share a room. I think we learned something while we were in rehab. Her program's her program, my program's my program. We leave each other alone. I don't tell her to call her sponsor. She don't tell me to call mine. I don't ask her what steps she's on. It's just something we learned how to do. And it's worked out real well for us. You know, we're happier today than we've ever been. We've been married almost 20 years. Best thing about that halfway house was I was paying my rent every week, and most of the people living there weren't, and I still had a little bit of game going, you know, so they had all these requirements like getting a sponsor and stuff, and I wasn't going to get a sponsor. And I found out that as long as I paid my rent, I didn't have to get one. And so the day that I was leaving the place, the guy that owned the place, he knew what was going on. He had game too, you know. And he asked me, he goes, "You got a sponsor, John?" I said, "No, I don't got one of those." He said, "Well," he gave me this phone number. He said, "If you call this guy and ask him to be your sponsor, he'll say yes." And it's a guy I'd been to meetings with before. I kind of didn't really know him, but I knew who he was. And so I called him. And that was my first sponsor. I can't stress enough the value of sponsorship in my life. The first real relationship I've ever had with a human being was with my first sponsor. My first sponsor used to, I'd call him every day, and this was prior to all the cell phone stuff, you know, so I got to know his schedule, and I would call him every day, and sometimes we'd talk about recovery, and sometimes we'd talk about other stuff, but I ended up having this relationship with this man, and he became my friend. We worked the steps. He took me through the steps. And what I remember most about that was he would take a step and make it completely simple. You know, I try to complicate it. He made it simple. And he was my sponsor for about 6 years. And one day he came up to my work, and I work in a grocery store, and he came in and told me he had to talk to me out in the parking lot, and I went out in the parking lot, and my first sponsor was about 5'6". He weighed about 220 pounds. His arms were as big as my thighs, and I mean, he was a rough-looking character, and he broke down into tears, bawling, and told me that he'd been using for the last month. And I told him that that was okay, and I gave him the key to my house. I told him, "Go over to my house." I go, it's going to take me about an hour to get out of this place, but you know, just wait at my house, and I'll come by when I get off, and we'll figure this out." And I did all that, and he tried to get clean again, and he never did. You know, he never put together more than 30 days again, until finally one day he just disappeared, and I haven't seen or heard from him in 7 or 8 years. Today I know what the final lesson that man taught me was, and that lesson is not to take for granted the gift that I have right now, the gift I've been given, and that gift is I have a choice right this minute not to pick up. The minute I use, I lose that choice. And I also need to remember that I might not ever get another chance at this again. And I don't ever want to forget that. And I did what I was taught to do. I got another sponsor. You know, I worked some more steps. I developed another relationship with another human being, and I've had five sponsors since I've been here. Two of them relapsed. One died. One I just couldn't, it just didn't work out with. And the sponsor that I have today, I talked to this morning, and I wished him a Merry Christmas. We talked a little bit, and that's just as important to me today as it was the day that, as it was early in my recovery. I don't know how to do this thing on my own. I need help. I need direction. I still have a home group. I've always had a home group. It's a critical part of my program. My home group's MIA. We meet Sunday at 4 o'clock, 35th Avenue, just south of Dunlop, or just south of Northern. And the important thing for me to remember about my home group is that's where I'm supposed to be Sunday at 4. There are exceptions, but they're few and far between. I know this because I've done that for 14 years, and it's worked. You know, I have a relationship with the people in that group. Like, it's different. You know, I'm a part of something. I attend the business meeting, and that's where my voice is heard. You know, I participate in my home group, and you know, I still work steps. I got up this morning, and I had a bad dream last night, and I still have those. And I woke up, and I was a wreck. And so I went outside. I said a little prayer. I read the Just for Today book. I took out my dictionary. I looked up a couple words, pulled out my journal, and I wrote a letter to God. And and it worked. You know, it was Christmas morning. I got a beautiful life today. You know, I woke my wife up, and because I know that my granddaughter, we were doing Christmas at her house this morning, and I know that here's this little 7-year-old kid that's got to wait for all these damn grown-ups to get up so that she can open her presents, and that's part of who I am today. You know, I got everybody up, and it was a beautiful Christmas. It was a beautiful day. I have a relationship with the God of my understanding today. And I cherish that because it didn't come easy to me. Nothing in this program came easy to me. The spiritual principles that we learn about in the steps contradict everything I learned out there. And it didn't come easy, but the thing has been I keep coming back. I keep doing what I was told to do when I got here, and the program keeps working. And I keep growing. I keep moving forward. And I'm telling you, the life that I have today is unlike anything I ever imagined for myself. And that's not based on material wealth and outside stuff to boost my ego. It's just about how I feel today. And it's a beautiful thing. You know, 14 years, a lot of things have happened. You know, I got out of that halfway house and I had to get a job. Judge said, get a job or go to prison. And I had to take a job bagging groceries in a grocery store. It's the only place they'd hire me. I mean, my sponsor told me if I filled out 100 applications, I'd get a job somewhere. And I was just filling out applications. So I went to work in this grocery store, and I know what it's like to bag groceries for people that I used to sell dope to. And I remember what it was like early in my recovery, not knowing if I was going to make enough money each month to pay the rent. I remembering having to humble myself and having my wife go down and get food stamps. I didn't go down and get them. I wouldn't spend them, but you know, I had to humble myself. I had to get to the point early in my recovery where I had to realize that I was going to be cared for. And because my sponsor told me that I would. He said, do the next right thing and everything will be all right. And I kept coming back and I kept doing the next right thing with the idea, the reservation in the back of my mind. When that didn't happen, I'd just go out and get loaded. The funny thing is since I've been coming here, that's always worked. I know what it's like to, I didn't bag groceries very long. You know, I moved up in that company. My wife got a job, and, next thing we bought a home. We were raising these kids, and the people that, when I got out of jail and out of rehab and all that stuff, I went back to the same house that I'd been busted in, and I lived there for the first year and a half I was clean. And then we got a fresh start. We moved a few miles away. And the neighbors I have today don't really know me, They ask me to watch their house when they go out of town and to pick up their mail. And if they were sitting in this room tonight, they would be sure that I'm standing up here lying, because that's not the person that they know. I walk out the front door of my house, and the two little girls that live across the street pop their heads up over the wall, and they say, hi, John, hi. And that's the person that I am today. It's a beautiful thing. My wife got really sick about 5 or 6 years ago. She started getting sick. And we didn't know what was wrong with her, and it took them about a year to diagnose what her illness was. And just like when I was using, I fought that the whole way, trying to think that I could control it and fix it and just fighting and fighting and fighting. She was in and out of hospitals. She got to the point that she couldn't work. She had a wheelchair and a walker. Our whole life was turned upside down. And I remember I was walking up to the hospital one time, and it was just another one of her stays in the hospital. I was working graveyards at the time, and I'd work all night and try to take care of the kids and stuff during the day and spend some time at the hospital. And I knew back then that every day that I got up that I was going to fall short. But I kept doing like my first sponsor told me to do. He said, just keep doing the next right thing, just for today. And I remember I was walking up to this hospital that night. It was Thunderbird Hospital. And I was smoking a cigarette. I was in the parking lot. And this nurse comes walking out of the building, and she says, the smoking section's over there. And I about snapped. I flung that cigarette over her head, and it went towards the smoking section and the ashtray. And I swear, if I had an extra 30 seconds, I'd have killed her, But I went into the hospital. I saw my wife there, and I told her I need to go to a meeting. I left the hospital. I went to a meeting that used to be at 71st Avenue and Cactus on Friday nights. I walk into that room, and the topic was surrender. And once again, my life changed. Today I know that my powerlessness goes far beyond just drugs. And the power of this program goes far beyond just my problems with addiction. My wife didn't instantly get better. But from that point forward, we started turning to a power greater than ourselves, and we ended up getting a hold of the best surgeon in the state, and a couple surgeries later, my wife's healthy today. And the reason I share that story is because I've had my ass kicked clean as bad as I had it out using. The key is surrender. I remember telling my first sponsor one time, I thought I knew something about surrender. And he told me I didn't know anything about surrender. He said I knew about getting my ass kicked. He said I needed to learn how to surrender. And over the years, I'm learning how to do that today. Another story I like to tell is my oldest daughter, the one I told you guys about, was standing at that front door. We had a lot of trouble with her through her teenage years. She grew up in a dope house. Her parents were addicts. And then all of a sudden we show up clean, and we're going to be the Cleavers, she ran away from home. She stole our cars. She stole our money. We had all kinds of trouble with her. But I went and picked her up one time from her apartment where she was having some trouble with her boyfriend. And I moved her back into the house. And the next day she told me she was pregnant. And this is another one of them stories I ain't real proud about, because I had a good bit of clean time at the time, 7-8 years. And I didn't explode, I didn't blow up, but I knew in the back of my head that this kid couldn't raise a child, and I knew that I wasn't going to raise a child, and I did everything in my power to manipulate and control that situation so that it would turn out the way that I wanted it to, and I just wanted her to get rid of it, either through adoption, abortion, whatever, just make it go away. And a funny thing happened. She's a pretty strong human being, and she decided to keep this baby. And I told her, I'm not going to change any diapers. You can live here, but I'm not going to support that kid. I'm not going to buy it food. I had all this list of things I wasn't going to do, and I lasted about 2 days. I know today that my higher power knows better what I need than I do, because the greatest gift of my life is that little granddaughter. I didn't know, I'm so tight with that little girl that it scares me. I love her so much that it scares me. We went and had Christmas at her house today. I got her dog. They're going out of town tomorrow, so I get to take care of her little Rottweiler puppy for a week. And she came over a couple weeks ago, and she was a little bit upset because they wouldn't let her bring her dog with her when she came to stay the weekend at my house. And I told her, from here on out, if anybody tells you you can't bring the dog with you, just tell them Grandpa said. And it ain't bad being Grandpa. I kind of like it. It's kind of cool. And I loaded up everything this morning. We kind of overdo Christmas at our house. I overdo it for the kids. I do that because I just remember some real crappy Christmases for them when they were little. And today I just try to overdo it a little bit. So I had this stuff loaded up on this. I had to take my trailer today to their house to load this game table that she was getting. And this is, I got up, I had that dream thing and did the beautiful prayer and the writing, and my spirit was awakened and I was happy, joyous, and free. And on my way down 51st Avenue going to her house, the back of the trailer fell off, it was just a gate, but I didn't have it bolted down right. Luckily it was Christmas morning, there wasn't a lot of traffic, but... I didn't flip out. I didn't explode. I didn't. It was just one of those things that happens. My youngest daughter just turned 18 a few months ago. I didn't tell the story about her fighting with the police not to take her dad away 14 years ago, but she came to visit me in jail one time, and she was going to take me home, and I told her, no, I can't go home. I got to stay here, and she wanted to kick the jailers, and she turned 18. I remember I got really, really weird about her turning 18. I remember her birthday was coming up and all this stressful stuff, because it is all about me, right? And at one point it dawned on me that this little girl's going to turn 18 years old, and I flashed back to what that cop said to me 14 years ago. And I realized that with the help of Narcotics Anonymous, I did get out of the drug business and I did raise those kids. And I'm real proud of that. And I'm real proud of Narcotics Anonymous. You know, I had a sponsor of mine that died a couple years ago. It was almost 2 years ago. And he lived down here for about 6 years. And he went back to Spokane, Washington. His name was Ken Coons. He went back to Spokane, Washington to die. And what that sponsor helped me learn the most was he wouldn't give me writing assignments and big fancy stuff. He would give me living assignments. You know, he would just ask me questions like, what principle are you struggling with today? And I'm real grateful for that because that's what it's about today. It's about living. You know, I suffer from a disease which is progressive, incurable, and fatal. And if it's not arrested, I know what lies ahead for me. My job today is simple. You know, I showed up here. I was selling pop behind the concession stand, and when they asked me if I'd speak, my job is to say yes. You know, and it's just that simple. Like I said earlier, I still got a sponsor. I still got a home group. I still work steps. Still got a service commitment. You know, I'm blessed with the honor of attending the. I get to attend a meeting at the federal prison north of town every Thursday night, and I get to sit down with the. It's the best meeting I attend every week. You know, we get anywhere from 10 to 30 guys, and they have a recovery community in that prison. They're real blessed out there. And it's the best meeting I attend every week because, probably because I'm never real excited about going there on Thursday. You know, I'll be griping and moaning the whole day, and the drive out there, it takes me an hour and 15 minutes to get there, and a funny thing happens. On the way home, I got this feeling, and I can't explain it, but I think it's gratitude. You know, this feeling overcomes me, and if you don't know what that feeling is, I hope you get to experience it someday, because it's why I keep going out there every Thursday. And I don't know, the most important thing I can share here tonight is, you know, it's Christmas Day, and the greatest gift I've ever been given was given to me from the God of my understanding through Narcotics Anonymous. And I want to thank you all very much. Thanks.